Disc 4. The Great Gatsby, concluded.
We saw the three or four automobiles in the crowd when we were still some distance away. "Wreck," said Tom. "That's good. Wilson will have a little business at last." He slowed down, but still without any intention of stopping, until as we came nearer, the hushed, intent faces of the people at the garage door made him automatically put on the brakes. "We'll take a look," he said doubtfully. "Just a look." I became aware now of a hollow, wailing sound which issued incessantly from the garage, a sound which, as we got out of the coupe and walked toward the door, resolved itself into the words, "Oh, my God," uttered over and over in a gasping moan. "There's some bad trouble here," said Tom excitedly. He reached up on tiptoes and peered over a circle of heads into the garage, which was lit only by a yellow light in a swinging wire basket overhead. Then he made a harsh sound in his throat, and with a violent thrusting movement of his powerful arms, pushed his way through. The circle closed up again with a running murmur of expostulation. It was a minute before I could see anything at all. Then new arrivals deranged the line, and Jordan and I were pushed suddenly inside. Myrtle Wilson's body, wrapped in a blanket and then in another blanket, as though she suffered from a chill in the hot night, lay on a work table by the wall, and Tom, with his back to us, was bending over it, motionless. Next to him stood a motorcycle policeman taking down names with much sweat and correction in a little book. At first I couldn't find the source of the high, groaning words that echoed clamorously through the bare garage. Then I saw Wilson standing on the raised threshold of his office, swaying back and forth and holding to the doorposts with both hands. Some man was talking to him in a low voice and attempting from time to time to lay a hand on his shoulder, but Wilson neither heard nor saw. His eyes would drop slowly from the swinging light to the laden table by the wall and then jerk back to the light again, and he gave out incessantly his high, horrible call. "Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, God! Oh, my God!" Presently, Tom lifted his head with a jerk, and after staring around the garage with glazed eyes, addressed a mumbled, incoherent remark to the policeman. "M-A-Y," the policeman was saying. "Oh, no, R," corrected the man. "M-A-V-R-O." "Listen to me," muttered Tom fiercely. "R," said the policeman. "O, G, G." He looked up as Tom's broad hand fell sharply on his shoulder. "What you want, fella?" "What happened? That's what I want to know." "Auto hit her. Instantly killed." "Instantly killed," repeated Tom, staring. "She ran out in a road. Son of a bitch didn't even stop his car." "There was two cars," said Michaelis. "One coming, one going, see?" "Going where?" asked the policeman keenly. "One going each way. Well, she..." His hand rose toward the blankets, but stopped halfway and fell to his side. "She ran out there, and the one coming from New York knocked right into her, going 30, 40 miles an hour." "What's the name of this place here?" demanded the officer. "Hasn't got any name." A pale, well-dressed Negro stepped near. "It was a yellow car," he said. "Big yellow car, new." "See the accident?" asked the policeman. "No, but the car passed me down the road, going faster than 40, going 50, 60. "Come here and let's have your name. Look out now, I want to get his name." Some words of this conversation must have reached Wilson swaying in the office door, for suddenly a new theme found voice among his gasping cries. "You don't have to tell me what kind of car it was. I know what kind of car it was." Watching Tom, I saw the wad of muscle back of his shoulder tighten under his coat. He walked quickly over to Wilson, and standing in front of him, seized him firmly by the upper arms. "You've got to pull yourself together," he said with soothing gruffness.